Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhan saranam gacchami, Dhamman saranam gacchami. Sangam saranam gacchami, dutiyampi Buddhan saranam gacchami, dutiyampi Dhamman saranam gacchami, dutiyampi Sangam saranam gacchami, tatiyampi Buddhan saranam gacchami, tatiyampi Dhamman saranam gacchami, tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. I vow to avoid killing living things. I vow to avoid taking what is not given. I vow to avoid sensual misconduct. I vow to avoid false speech. I vow to avoid malicious speech. I vow to avoid harsh speech. I vow to avoid gossip. I vow to avoid covetousness. I vow to avoid ill will. I vow to avoid wrong view. So that third precept, I vow to avoid sensual misconduct. We are always calling it sexual misconduct because that's one area that that is so prevalent in our cultures, that grasping and craving and wanting something that is not ours. But when the Buddha was talking about this, it was in the plural, and he was talking about setting a watch over the sense gates. The internal base meeting the external base, consciousness arises, the three of those make contact, and with contact comes the whole ball of suffering, you know. And so he said to be careful how we see, be careful how we hear, be careful what we think, what taste, touch, smell. He included thinking as a sense gate to help us to recognize that there is an internal base, the faculty of thinking that makes contact with, that touches an external base, thought. Consciousness arises around that thought, and the three of those make contact, and with contact comes feeling. I like it, I don't like it, or I'm ambivalent about it because it's pleasant, it's unpleasant, or there's a neutrality to it. So if you really look at it, everything that produces our world is based on the internal base meeting an external base, consciousness arising, and those three making contact. And so when he encouraged us to be careful, to avoid, to watch what contact the base makes, he was giving us the key to finding our happiness. So he talks about two kinds of consciousnesses, and actually he breaks it down into many, many kinds, but all of them except one falls into the category of the consciousness that arises from the internal base making contact with the external base. And then he talks about one kind of consciousness that arises separate and detached from an internal base meeting an external base. He said that this is the one that we discover when we practice concentration to a level of attainment. And so we have all these words that sometimes we're scared of, like jhana and so forth, but it just means a first level of attainment. And so we stay away from whatever we are not that familiar with, and the more we stay away from something, even if the Buddha talked about it, the more we become sure that it's something we should stay away from. You know, but there's a saying that wide is the gate, you know, to perdition. Narrow is the way, and few there be that find it. So sometimes what is the most broadly offered is the wide gate, but those that excel look for the narrow gate. So I want to talk to you a little bit about that narrow gate tonight, but in a little different way than we normally think about it. It's going to be through a vehicle and a practice that we already know, but I want to talk about the flip side of that practice. So I'm going to actually be talking about the four Brahma Viharas tonight, but about their functions in the higher altitude of harmony. You see, because we're looking for answers to the problems, the challenges that we face in the world today, just being able to get along with one another. You know, and we're really into a diversity thing, but the Buddha didn't talk that much about diversity other than say this is a world where you have different bodies, different minds, da-da, diversity. So that means there's no way, we don't even have to talk about that. That is a fact. But he turned us not from he turned us away from the diversity and he pointed towards unity. He says there is a way that we can live in unity and in harmony. And so he encourages us to use his proved methods. I know, you know, we have our own as well. We have our ways of doing things and we have our experts. And, you know, I was very happy to be on this 3-year steering committee for the teachers' conference that occurred a couple of months ago. And it was 3 years of really, we were having intense discussions around what should be offered and, you know, addressing some of the problems and how they should be addressed and what advice and what wisdom we could offer. And somehow I ended up being the lone wolf on the whole steering committee. And I just kept saying, what? Didn't the Buddha have anything to say about this? Didn't he have any wisdom? I mean, he has the Sutta on non-conflict. He has, I mean, you can just go through the suttas and find out what he says about, you know, others do that, we don't do that here. That's like, period. We don't do that here, period. You know, so if we're doing that here, then we're like the others, the ones that we talk about, the ones that we think shouldn't be that way, but we do that here. So he starts right there. Others do this, we don't do that here. And if we are, then we need to look at that. And so he goes through this whole litany of what others do, and he says, but we don't do that. So he's talking about a mode of living, our conduct, needing to conform to our greatest aspirations. Now, my conduct conforming to my greatest aspirations doesn't have as much to do with you as it has to do with me. It's like if I come into a place and, like, and, you know, I hear it all the time, I don't feel safe, I don't feel safe, you know. But if I'm relying on you to make me feel safe, I might never be safe. So I'm gonna have to find safety within myself. That's why I can go into any room with anybody. I went to, we stopped, there's a, I live in a little small town now. And right in the heart of our downtown, which is 2 blocks long, there is I can't think of the name of the Bennigan's. Well, it's something, and it's Flanagan's. And, you know, and everybody who comes into Flanagan's is wearing black leather and chains and, you know, and tattoos and but I go into Flanagan's all the time, you know, and people are like, You know, when I walk in the door, maybe all heads turn because I go in the flannel. I just walk right up to the bar, slap somebody on the back, and say, "How are you?" And then we have this conversation. And these are some of the most wonderful people. But if I had judged them by some kind of stereotype, and if I had fear of them, then I wouldn't be able to do that. You know. But I don't. I don't. If I'm looking to you to experience love, I might never be loved. So I better make sure I have enough for myself. And I do have enough for myself. You see, and so what I love about the Dharma is how it strengthens us. How it was so wonderful to know that I'm not helpless. It was wonderful to know that I'm not dependent on anybody else for my happiness. It was wonderful to know that I don't need a leader. It was wonderful to know that having an ally is fine, but not having an ally is just perfectly okay because I can be an ally for myself and an advocate too. And there's something about being able to walk in that way that gives you a certain stability, it gives you a certain comfort, it gives you an absolute peace, and it gives you a fearlessness. And when other people see it, and when you see other people, if you are harmonized in your own mind, then you can understand, you can know the minds of others. So often there is one who has this outward mode of being, this outward behavior, and it may be brash and it may be in your face, but I can look and I can see the insecurity because I have overcome that in me. And so as you sit there and you work a crowd with your mind, wrapping mind, I tell you, if we keep practicing, folk not gonna be able to fake it. It's the truth. They're just not going to be able to fake it. We're going to have to get genuine because everybody will know. Right now, because there's still too much ignorance in the sense of not knowing, not in the sense of being stupid, in the sense of not knowing how something is, not seeing the face of the real. That we, or getting it in pieces, getting it in parts. I watched TED Talks one day, a couple of weeks ago, and they were saying how there was a woman on, she was a linguist, and she was teaching, her teaching was for executives and leaders on how to say their name. And she said that when you say your name, "I'm Bob Jones," then it runs downhill. But when you say, "I'm Bob Jones," and you leave it on an upswing, then the person is more apt to remember your name. And she said, and when you speak, everything goes like in a rhythm like this, and the mind doesn't bother with all the details. It just picks from inflection in the voice. Now, I didn't take her course, but now I understand why. I understand my mode of delivery that came through my study of the Dharma. You know, there are these five brightnesses that occur, and one of them is the brightness of speech, being able to communicate in a certain way, being able to get something across in a certain way. And it wasn't a skill that I had until I began to study the Dharma, and it came up, you know, side by side with the Dharma, and my mode of being changed. But she helped me to understand what that means and its effect on people. And so she said, so when you're talking and the mind is like, "I'll take this, and I'll just fill in the rest." And that's what the mind does. And that's why two people can hear the same thing and they walk away, they have a completely different takeaway. They said, well, I heard something else. No, that's not what she said. No, that's not what you said. Or that's not what I saw. Or that's not what happened. You know, because we hit the peaks and mind fills in the rest for us. And so knowing this helps us to understand why we get it wrong sometimes. And why we need to leave a little space in there so that when we think we've walked away with what was really said, what actually occurred, that there's some space in there for some adjustment. If we live in this kind of way, that is the beginning of us being a little more harmonized. And it goes beyond that. It starts to go towards intent. Like, what is the intent of something? We're so wrapped around words. Words. Words mean so much to us. But what is the intent of the word? We can't even get to the intent because we're stuck on the words. We have to go deeper than that. And so the Buddha always talks about his teachings and how they were like pointing to something. He said, it's not the thing itself. It's pointing to something. Just look over in that direction. Because he recognizes that it produces a leaning towards, so that the mind inclines in a certain way. It leans towards something. So he says, mind is chief, mind made, are we? Whatever we think and ponder on, that becomes the inclination of our mind. He abused me, he beat me, he robbed me. Those who harbor such thoughts, in them anger shall never be appeased. So that's it right there. What are you going to do with that? And it doesn't have to be about anger. It can be about anything. It can be about guilt. It can be about shame. It can be about worry. It can be about doubt. It can be about grief. It can be on and on and on and on. And so we have to pay close attention to where and how the mind is leaning. So he said, well, I can help you out with that. And he introduced a practice. We called it the metta practice, the metta practice, and the ascent into the Brahma Viharas. Now, each one of these has its own role, its own function. And sometimes, you know, I always tell the story about the plumber who was called in, and he worked on something for a minute and came back and gave him a $1,000 bill. And she said, well, you know, I need a line item on this because you were only in there for a minute. So he wrote out one, and $1 for tapping, $999 for knowing where to tap. And so it's like that. So sometimes we're trying to work on something, but we can't work through it because we're not tapping in the right place. So I wanted to talk about the meaning of the Brahma Viharas. I tell the story so many times about my father. He was born in 1899, and there weren't that many opportunities for a black man in that time. But I would see him go to work, and he was like all dressed up in this uniform with brass buttons and tassels, and I was like, wow, he must have a really, really high and important job. And one day when I was six, he took me to work with him, and I found out that my father was a doorman. His job was to open the doors for people and to carry their bags. And I watched how they treated him. And he was this big man in my sight, but he was a boy to them. He was a big man, and he was a grown man, but he was a boy to them. And he tucked his head and he said, yes, sir, yes, sir. And they're like, boy, get those bags and do, yes, sir. And something, it affected me, you know? So all my life I had this problem with doors. And it's like, if I open a door, you better not walk through it. If I open that door, I'm opening that door for me. And so, I mean, you know, it's just like, you know how you go to the mall and everybody's coming to the mall and you open the door and sometimes somebody just walk in. There are two people carrying on a conversation, the door swings open and then I just walk in, you know, not meaning to do anything, not meaning to cause harm, just basically, you know, unmindful, you know. But if I was in a certain state of mind, certain mental state, you walk through that door, or tried to walk through that door, then you're going to be in trouble. Because I was going to grab you. You think I opened that door for you? But now, if I was in a different state of mind, I could open that door, and you could walk through. And I'm like, that's rude. You're welcome. If I was in another state of mind, I could open that door, and you could walk through, and it just gave me great pleasure. I mean, that's only natural. I approach the door first. You know, it's just courteous. Open the door, and there's someone right behind. It's more like how, just a generous, courteous thing to do. And if I was in a really good state of mind, I opened that door, and you could walk through, and I didn't even recognize that you walk through the door that I opened. It wasn't any sense of I opened the door and you walk through. You see what I mean? And these are different levels of harmonization. And how I reacted towards the opening of the door and someone walking through, it was the same act four times. But four different ways of seeing what just happened, you see. And so he talks about us cultivating these mental states because they color for us. They affect us in a certain way, and we look at what just happened differently. And being able to be in that space where we're more harmonized, we are able to interact with one another from a higher plane, if you will, of being. And he talks about the Brahma Viharas, the God realm. And he talks about beings because, you know, we're not alone in the universe, right? I don't think anybody thinks that, okay? Right? Yeah, okay. We just don't think that there's billions and billions of galaxies and it's only us. And we are at the top of the food chain. I don't think so. And so he talks about different beings on different planes. That's called him the tamer of gods and men. You know, and we don't have to get hung up on the word God. God seems to imply something to us that is a little more refined, a little more powerful to do good and powerful to create than we think of with our ordinary minds, that's all. So if you just think about it in that way, and we don't have to like name any but just knowing that there are different kinds of beings that have different mentality, different materiality. And we know ourselves that when we talk about some beings, like we talk about maybe being ferocious, like a tiger, you know, or I wouldn't think of a ferocious gerbil. We look at the behaviors and we have some way of knowing some qualities of different beings. And so he was talking about the qualities of beings who have a more refined mind than us. And he said, you know, the good thing is that if you practice, he said, upon dissolution of the body and the breaking apart of these five aggregates, should there be a rebirth linking consciousness in another realm, it'll be in the realm where the mind abides, the mind state. It says, and of course, if you don't believe that and there's nothing else after this, then you will have had a pleasant abiding here and now. And those that you consider wise, you know, will love you and have respect for you. So you can take it for what it does now, and if there's anything afterwards, which he said it is, but don't have to worry about it. You know, because the thing is, like, if you plant apple seeds and you water the ground and it gets the right amount of shade and the right amount of sunshine, you know, it's a good chance you're going to have an apple tree. It's not a good chance that you're going to have a lemon tree. So whatever you plant, that's going to grow. He says that's why you don't have to worry. He said, I talk about these things, but that's not my doctrine. I don't teach about it. I'm just telling you, oh, by the way, you know. So, and he says, and I just say, just pay attention to what seeds you're planting, because that's the tree that's going to grow. And if there is any future beyond this life, then that karma or that harvest is going to be after its own kind, whatever you plant. There will be a harvesting of that. It said, and this is a natural law. You could just see that everywhere. You know, it said you don't need a sage to tell you that. You just need to be looking, and you can see that. And so when we think of loving kindness and the Metta Sutta and the Metta practice, you know, and everybody knows how that came about, right, that particular practice. Is there anybody who doesn't know? Okay, so I'll give the short version then, since it's only a hand for you. So the bhikkhus were in the forest, and the Buddha had left them there and said, you all meditate. And he went off someplace else, and they were there for a while. And in the beginning, everything seemed nice. Oh, we're in the forest, we're away from the people, we're in the forest. And they're just meditating and pretty much otherwise just being themselves. You know, the thing about being monks, we think, oh, like, this is like this set apart group of people. But no, those are the people who were out there, then they all came in here, you know. So same people, may cultivate, may not cultivate, you know. But if they're cultivated, they're different. If not, same. Same as the ones that were out there. It's just that in here, now you can't get away from them. Out there, you could go home. In here, you're all home together. So if you have any romantic ideas about, you know, monastic life, forget it. It's not really like that. It really does call for a lot more practice, because I can't just go to my house and shut my door and lock you out. I have to be there with others, and I have to necessarily learn how to get along with others. It's an intensive practice, especially after you've given up everything, because you can't, like, just get your stuff and get your money and go, because you don't have any of that. You know? So you're, like, between a rock and a hard place, you know. But it enables us to be able to fiercely practice. So when the Buddha talks about the household life, you know, and it appears that he's saying something a little negative in it, so we try to find ways to make it not sound so negative, you know. But he's really not talking about it in a negative way. He's just simply saying that because you have we talk about the suffering, but there's also a certain ease of living. Like, if you don't like being here, you can go over there. If you don't like doing this, you can just quit that and go do that. If you don't like her, you can leave her and go for her. If you don't like, I mean, so we have a lot more, we've given ourselves more options. But all we've done is we've kind of refined our options. And we just said, like, these three and no more, you know. And pressing in that way, scrubbing and cutting away in that way, maybe there's an opportunity, you know, to penetrate a little deeper, because where you might be working 8 hours in a day, because I don't have to work in that way, I have time that I can devote to more practice. And we do know that you know, the more we practice at something, the better we get. But not just practice, you know, because practice doesn't make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect. So we need to have more time to practice, and it needs to be perfect practice. So he says to have a perfect practice, the mind needs to be resting in a certain place. So he tells us the meaning of loving kindness, the meaning of compassion, the meaning of sympathetic joy, joy in the successes of others, the meaning of equanimity. So he said, as to the meaning of loving kindness, it fattens, F-A-T-T-E-N-S. It fattens, it enlarges, it's like expanding outward. So when loving kindness is present with me, I have a sense of being enlarged, of being full, of being expanded. It necessarily covers at least another. And it's like it has an element of respect. It has an element of respect in it. So if we're trying to be kind to someone, or loving, but we don't have that element of respect, it falls flat. When I'm giving myself to you, when I'm wrapping myself around you, there is the platform that says you are worthy of this. It's an offering of worth. How can I say it? It's more than just doing something for somebody. Because as long as there's that notion of feeling kindness towards you or being kind towards you, there is me doing something for you. But when there's that fattening, that enlargement, that covering, then there is no sense of me doing something for a you. There is just this one. I won't even say us. There's just this one. Because I have expanded out and I've covered you. But when we talk about compassion, it's a little bit different. Because compassion comes from a good heart. So we can be mindful all day long, and we can get A pluses in mindfulness, but sociopaths are mindful. You know, so it's just a matter of what are we mindful of. So it takes more than mindfulness, it takes the cultivation of a good heart. And cultivation of a good heart is more than saying, may I be well and happy and peaceful. May my loved ones be well and happy and peaceful. May my neighbors be well and happy, and my friends too. And then, and finally, my enemies, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It's more than that. It's more than the recitation. There is something, there is an emptying out of oneself that's required in this. There is an attitude of harmony that is mandated. So it means that there's heart work that we have to do. And it says that what compassion does it is that it demolishes the suffering of others. Now, or alternatively, it scatters So where someone is bound up or where they're crowded in, it cuts a path. It makes a space. And in this compassion, as we call it, we have to be careful about something because we have to know the characteristic of this thing. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But when we talk about sympathetic joy, joy in the successes of others, we can't do that if we are lacking in the respect for them. And that started with which Brahma Vihara? Yeah, it started with loving kindness. Yeah, because that was where the mounting up starts, with respect. So we really can't be compassionate apart from also having respect for. When there's that respect, there's no thought of I am doing for you. Some people think they are so compassionate, you know. And I tell them sometimes, like my granddaughter said to me when I was trying to help her tie her shoe. She seemed to be struggling with it, so I went down and said, "Oh, Grandma, by myself." You know. Sometimes we want to help people and we jump out front to lead, you know. And it was like, lead from behind. You know. Don't usurp my space, my place. If you come to join with me, co-labor with me as I'm doing something, don't think you need to tell me how to do it and speak for me. Yeah. So when I'm working with the untouchables in India, I'm very careful not to go there with any mind that I know what they need. I just go. And I bear witness to what's there. And I ask, how can I be a part of this? And then I listen for the answer. And then I step forward according to their wishes and instruction. I don't go in, okay, I know what y'all need, and just start doing things. It is in this way that I show them respect. And because I show them respect, the loving kindness can flow. And because the loving kindness can flow, compassion has a platform for arising. Now, the thing about what loving kindness does is it removes annoyance. You just really can't be kind and annoyed at the same time. Even in the South, where I am now, where everybody has a smile on their face, you don't know what's behind that smile, but that's just the Southern way. We just smile. I said, "Oh, I need to go back north. At least I know exactly what's what." You know, if they don't feel like smiling, there's no smile. You know, but here I'm like confused. They were smiling. I thought it was okay, and I get a phone call later. You know that? That's not gonna happen. So it was a little learning curve. But it's the removal of annoyance, and its proximate cause is seeing the lovableness in people. If you don't see the lovableness, if the eye is faulty, can I see it? Then the loving kindness cannot manifest. And the compassion is characterized by allaying the suffering of others, but it does not reside in bearing the burden of others. You see, this is how we get it a little bit messed up. Can I find that demarcation between allaying the suffering and bearing the burden? The Buddha said that once we fall into sorrow over someone's suffering. We just became of no use. So we have to hold things in a certain container. But once we slip outside of that container, then the good we thought we were doing, we're no longer able to do. And so we have to be very careful in our doing, that we're there to help allay, but that we don't take on the suffering of others. And so when I'm working with someone and they're in deep sorrow, I can only go so far with them in the feeling of infirmity before I've just become of no use to them, no help to them. He said, if you want to help somebody get out of a hole, you cannot jump in the hole with them. He said, you have to reach in, get that leverage, and pull them out. And he says, we have to learn how to do this through trial and error. But if we don't know to do it, we're just running off with our mind and our conception of what something is. No. But he says, sit and ponder these things, and the wisdom will rise up from you inside. How far to go, what to do, when to step forward, when to speak, when to hold your peace, when to just bear witness, when, you know, it's not so much in the doing, but in the preparation and the presence. And then he talks about gladness. And its function resides in not being envious. You know, so rejoicing in the successes of others. I mean, truly rejoicing. Not, oh, that's so wonderful. Yeah, but she didn't really deserve it. Oh, that's so great. I wonder why they didn't pick me. It's a, you know, and so there's this, we're looking for that little bit of envy, that little bit of self-grasping, that little bit of, you know, if we're really honest about it, we get a lot of things that we don't deserve, bad and good. But right now I'm speaking about good. We get a lot of things that we don't really deserve, but we don't be like, oh, but she didn't deserve it. You know, it's like we start pulling words that's not even in our jargon, talking about grace and it was divine. And, you know, we find all kinds of words. It was a miracle. It was like, you know, but it's like that. You know, everything, you see where it starts. It starts from R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Yeah, you know. And that's in loving, being kind. So we have to have a zeal for loving, being kind. We have to have a leaning towards loving, being kind. And one is like a stream that flows into a, what do they flow into? Rivers? Okay. And like the river that flows into the, where do they flow? The sea? Okay. Yeah. So I'm just talking about, you start with one little thing. You don't have to have the whole ball of wax. You don't have to be practicing on all these things. You start with R-E-S-P-E-C-T. That's all. And that can be an object or subject of meditation, looking at all the facets of respect, all of the qualities of respect, seeing the lovableness in people, knowing where to tap. And he says that when we are good at this, the aversion to what is happening begins to fall away. It doesn't mean that it's all right. But the aversion to it falls away. We can actually look at it for what it is. We can look at it, and because we have harmonized, there is no sense of blame and there's no sense of shame. It's like, this is something right here and we need to work on this. And that sets a whole new environment for problem solving. So we think we have to fix this problem out here. But he's saying, no, you have to fix in here. And then you have to know how to offer wise attention. And that what produces the wise attention is not just the mindfulness, but it's the cultivation of the heart, seeing others as oneself. And so he says that we can use these states or a zeal for entering into them. And it's like, I used to be an Amway distributor. And, you know, we had one schlick with the Amway. And if anybody is an Amway distributor, I'm not in any way, you know, denigrating or talking about it. I'm just saying, just telling the truth about this, is that we had lots of great products. They might have been overpriced because we all had to get paid. But there was one particular product that we had. And we would, every time we did like a home meeting or a demonstration, we'd pull out this product. And first we'd like, you know, a red dye. I forget what the number was. Is it two or is it five? But it's the dye that doesn't come out. And we would put it on a white fabric, this red, it was Kool-Aid. And you know, everybody knew you like you get Kool-Aid on your white blouse, just forget it. I mean, bleach doesn't work. I mean, like nothing works. And so then we take a little bit of this particular product with an eyedropper and we put it on that spot and do like this, dip it in the water. And it came out, and it was the oohs and the ahs, and everybody bought product, but more importantly, they signed up and they sold this product. And he says that it's like that with us in our normal mode of seeing. The structure of appearance is faulty. We think we're seeing clearly, but he says the structure of appearance is faulty. It's like the red dye on the blouse, seeing through a faulty lens. And he says, cultivating these states is like putting a dropper full of that product on that stain. And it eats away at it until it ultimately dissolves. And we come forth pure and clean. And he says, in this space, we see without the colored lens of our experience, without the colored lens of our pain, without the colored lens of our confusion, without the colored lens of our separateness. If we want to come together, he said, we have to see our unity. We have to see that part that is together. The more that we see it, the more its qualities impinge on us. And the more fruit after its own kind is produced. And so there is a space for talking about our differences, but it is together we talk about them. I remember when I was first invited, and I'm going to end in a minute, because after we take our break or whatever you all do after the Dhamma talk, we're going to allow this meditation to be informed by the Dhamma talk. That's why I give the meditation after the Dhamma talk. Because when we come in, we're just trying to settle down from our outside stuff. And by the time we finish settling down from that, meditation's over. But this way, we've already put that away before we sit. And so when we sit now, we don't have to get away from the vicissitudes of life. We dropped those 30 minutes ago. And we're refining now. We're homing in on what matters. And when we sit with this, there won't be so many thoughts popping off. Spend the first 35 or the 45 minutes, you know, mind going this, mind going that, mind going, because we're already started bringing it in. It's like the light being, you know, refracted like that and coming in like a laser. And we can like just get right to it. And then this sitting, instead of the may I be well and happy and peaceful, may no harm come to me, no danger, all of that. We're examining the quality of loving kindness. We're touching and delineating the characteristics of respect. We are examining whether we actually embrace the notion that others are as lovable as we are. We are allowing these ingredients to be separated so that we can look at them one by one and then bring them all back together. And in that space, we come away with a very firm understanding of what loving kindness is and how it comes about. What are the factors or its ingredients? How it is promoted and developed, and where it inures. It inures to a compassion. And where is that boundary? Once I fall down into the sorrow, I've lost my effectiveness. And it allows a gladdening to arise, whether the person is friend to us or we don't consider a friend. We won't have to discriminate on that, based on that, but that we can find joy in whatever that comes forth that is good, whether we thought we deserved it instead of them or not. The thing about that one, though, I'm going to tell you, and I am through, but I'll tell you, the thing about rejoicing in the successes of others is I don't always have a good day. But if I can find something in someone else's life to rejoice about, that makes every day a good day for me. And that's what I live by, because I'm not really into suffering. And so I'm always looking. If my day's not good, I trade my day for yours. What happened good in your world? And so there was a guy I'll never forget, it's 20 years now, and I still think about it all the time. Every day I would get on the elevator in my apartment, and he'd be on the elevator. I'd say, good morning, how are you today? Oh, it's a terrible day. It was 8:30 in the morning. Oh, it's a terrible day. And he, all the way down, I was like on the 12th floor, I think, or 10th or 12th. All the way down, I have to listen to how bad the day was before I got. So I started getting to the place that if I went and pushed that button, that door opened, he was whatever. Oh, I forgot something. I go back to my apartment because I did not want to start my day off that way. You know? And so it's like that. You know? You don't have to start your day off that way, and you don't have to continue. And when, you know, your day is not going so good, get into somebody else's day and find some happiness in that. And before you know it, you know, their joy becomes your joy. If I say to myself, I shall put on a happy face, then and only then can my countenance be changed. You see, we have to mount up. We have to arise to something. And that comes from the inside. You can't get that from a book. You know, you have to bring that for out of your belly, living waters flow. You have to bring that up from the inside. But once that is full, it's full to overflowing, that's when the equanimity comes. And that's different from being indifferent. Equanimity has the quality of fullness. That there is maybe something that can be done, maybe nothing can be done at this time. It brings with it the capacity for patience and persistence. Patience and persistence. Patience and persistence. And finding that balance between patience and persistence. You know what's so fun, wonderful about all this is the Buddha says we possess all of these qualities, but we have to dig for them. And so when we're meditating, sometimes it's okay to just sit there and to note whatever is arising and see it arise, abide for a while, and fall off. But sometimes we have to bring forth a zeal and a concentration like a laser to home in on these qualities and virtues that we are cultivating. And when we have done that successfully, we will see it outpictured in our lives. Yeah? So this kind of meditation that we're doing tonight is to come to the absolute stilling of thought. We're going to start with one thing. He says it's funny. To come to the absolute stilling of thought, he first gives the mind something to do. So we apply thought. In this case, it's loving kindness. What is that? What are the qualities? What are the characteristics? How is it embellished? How does it grow? How is it diminished? How is it uprooted? Applied thought means we take our attention to it. Sustained thought means we keep our attention there. Like training the puppy to the paper. Every time the puppy runs off, you put him back on the paper. Tinkle right here. He runs off, put tinkle right here. You know, so that's applying if the mind runs off. Sustaining is when you can just keep it right there. Just keeping it right there. Just on loving kindness. He said, and once you do that, there is a joy that begins to rise. And this joy is based on confidence. There's a sense of being confident, being qualified. There's a sense of being settled, of being rooted, of being established. And it comes from the stillness and the ability to just stay with your subject. And he says, and first that feels like very active, energetic, kind of exciting, like, to find that we have this capacity to not like turn away from the issue or jump into our emotion about it, about the feelings, like emotional feelings that we have about something, that we can like sit and we can just look at that. Don't have to run away from it. Don't have to eyes. Don't have to pretend it's not happening. And we don't have to grab our weapons and run to defend. I'm looking. And so there's some excitement, like, yeah, I got this. I'm really doing it. I'm examining this very closely. And that's like seeing a pond of water, or whatever you call it, on the oasis, on the desert. You know, and you've been clawing and scratching in the dirt and hot in the sand and the hot sun, and you see that oasis, and it's a real one too, not a mirage. It's a real one, and then you like start getting excited because I know, I'm about to get okay in a minute, you know. He said, but then after a while, it takes on a different quality, and it's the quality of having reached that oasis and taken a sip. So there's like this copacetic kind of feeling. Says, and then something else happens. Now you no longer have to apply and sustain thought because your mind will want to rest there. He says, it is a pleasure not born of this world. And so you just sit and you rest with it. No need to move anywhere. No need for the mind to get up and run off for anything. It just finds a steadiness and a contentment right there. For this moment, all I'm doing is becoming acquainted with loving kindness, what it feels like, what its qualities are, how it is aroused. And that's it. That's the meditation for tonight. So I think we need to take a break and take a stretch. Why don't we do that now?